as possible. I must admit, I saw that and I thought, whoa. Because I've done a few of those. Don't want to do another one. it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. It's interesting projects. You kind of, there's the inspiration, the vision, then there's the, you start to do it, then there's all the hassles and all that. And then there's the reward of the project, you know, the reward of seeing the whole thing function. But at some point, I think, enough with projects? Anyone there yet? Enough with rebirth? And there's a story, the first monk I met, Sannyanasuchi. Where do we leave off on that one? Sannyanasuchi had gone off to Nepal, right? And you remember chapter 2, was it? And so he disrobed and he went to Boulder, Colorado for 3 years. And he thought he could find some kind of Buddhist community there, but it didn't work out, so he went, came back to the robe. So then he was Venerable Bodhisattva, and I met him again in Thailand. So it was really nice. Unfortunately, he died. He went back to Nepal again, and he had a ruptured hernia, is it it? Which went septic, and he died in Nepal, a very painful death. But I owe very much to him. But anyway, he had a lovely story he wrote, which was based on the myth of Sisyphus. Remember Sisyphus? For some misdemeanor, right? He had to carry a rock up a mountain. Right? Forget what. Remember what the misdemeanor was?
Giving man fire.
Wasn't that, that was the other one. That was Prometheus. What does Sisyphus do? Anyway, some misdemeanor of the gods. You be careful with the gods. Cheated death. Okay.
Went across a river Styx when he wasn't supposed to or something.
All right. So the gods punished Sisyphus, and his punishment was that he had to carry a huge boulder up a mountain, and just as he got to the top, the boulder would fall, roll to the ground, and he'd start again, ad infinitum. So the Bodhisattva's take on this story, so Sisyphus is carrying this rock, oh God, don't get to the top, almost to the top, falls off his shoulder, goes down. He's been doing this for several eons now. And so he's carrying this rock up and rolls down again, gets down to the bottom, and there's an old man there. And he's No, he gets to the top, okay, he gets to the top, the rock falls down, and he's just about to go down, he sees this old man at the top. Never seen an old man before. And looks at the old man, just about to go down, he says, Sisyphus, I'm an old man, pick me up, carry me down. I can't, I'm an old man. Sisyphus, it's the only nice part of the journey for Sisyphus, because he doesn't have to carry the damn rock, right? He says, Sisyphus, please. In my country, we have the concept of karma. And if you carry me down, something good might happen to you. So Sisyphus, all right. So Sisyphus throws him on his shoulders and he goes down, grumbling down. Gets down to the bottom and the old guy jumps off and walks away. Doesn't even say thank you. Just walks away. Sisyphus, see? So then there's the old trusty rock again. Sisyphus rock. And he picks up the rock and puts it on his shoulders. And carrying up the rock, up the hill, slippery again, slipping off his back. He's almost to the top. He makes it. He makes it to the top. And he sets the rock down. It doesn't roll down. He sets it down and look, for the first time in his life, he's in this incredible vista. Just this incredible view. And he's exhausted. He's been doing this for a few eons. He needs to catch up on his sleep. So old Sisyphus lays down as a good old sleep. He just sleeps and sleeps. And he wakes up, and the view is so beautiful. And he looks around. That's so beautiful. You know what I'll do? I'll build a house up here. Yeah, I'll start with my rock as the cornerstone. And I'll carry some more rocks up. So he runs down the hill, and he gets another rock, and carries on with projects. And hence rebirth. So there's good karma and there's end of karma. And the end of karma is really rather difficult, because it's the more profound part of Buddhism. But you need good karma, you need light karma to have the clarity. So a lot of what we do is creating a foundation for the deeper kind of insights into the path. But there's something about our minds when we reach peace or disappointment or the kind of valleys of life. Quite often, rather than stay with the valley, stay with the down, we either take it and it drags us down into sort of depressed states. That happens. But oftentimes we don't have the patience just to live in the kind of seeming grayness of it. We seek rebirth. So when there's disappointment, we seek something which will fulfill our expectations, and we go off again into other projects of the mind, of thought, of vision. And so the whole sense of future gets very much conditioned. Past future. So the whole sense of allowing something to cease is very, very profound. Because just notice now how much are we thinking about the future. You know, the retreat comes as it comes to an end. We have to plan. You know, I hope I get a lift tomorrow. So we need to plan. But the whole thing, this constant movement into the next. So this mind, which is constantly being reborn with anticipation and this constant becoming, is a powerful energy. It's not just some little trickle in the mind. It's this powerful force that we deal with. So the project of the end of karma is not a becoming. It's not like we're going somewhere, which is like I always joke that nirvana sounds like it's Santa Fe or Florida or Disneyland, some kind of place you go to. So there's this movement into the future, but really the realization of the deathless is through the abandonment, through the deconstruction, through the letting go of things, through the letting go of desire. And one of the ways where you let go of that is when there is like disappointment, and like feeling something like disappointment, and not going to build another castle which you think is going to be fulfilling in some way. Which doesn't mean we can't do things, we can't have projects, but to seek ourselves in projects is different than doing projects out of altruism. So much of Buddhist social philosophy, the motivation is based on compassion and altruism. But that's not the goal. It's not the goal, it's the altruism is rather what you practice in to free the mind. So like my goal in life isn't to be a monk, or that's not the point of my life. Monasticism is what I practice in. That's what I do. And I live by a certain social convention. And the Buddhism grew in two parallel social cultures. One was monasticism and one was the laity. So monastics aren't really, we're not priests. We're just kind of doing the work and trying to figure out the teaching and doing the best we can within our communities. And the lay communities are doing the same. So we're not intermediaries to truth. It's really a teaching individual to try to realize the truth. There has been a kind of priestly function which has grown up in Buddhist countries around monks and nuns, but that's a cultural thing. The our tradition, it's kind of sometimes called the wilderness tradition, where the monks of old lived in in the forest, did their practices, and then shared whatever they knew. That's how Howajin Cha started. He started teaching by just setting up his mosquito net in a forest near his home village and just practiced. And then people would come and offer him food. He'd put alms around, and then people knew he was there and they would start to take teaching, and it just grew around that. But so monasticism is very hard to understand unless you live it. It's a kind of language. It's like it's hard to understand Latvian unless you know Latvian. So there's a lot of confusion about monasticism, about the relationship of monks and nuns and things like that. But you have to sort of really be in it, understand the culture, understand the history to get a feeling for it. So that's been my kind of social dharma this lifetime, learning about myself in that social context and trying to offer whatever energy I can to make that happen. Lay life is much more diffuse because lay people have so many different options and different kinds of responsibilities. So the social dharma for lay people isn't so clearly laid out. For monastics, it's very clearly laid out. But it's not dead. We're constantly just kind of considering, how can we use this vehicle in this non-Buddhist context? Because we're a real oddity. I guess in North American Buddhism there aren't really that many monastics, and whether monasticism will survive or not is yet to be seen. And those are all in the area of social Buddhism. And as I was saying, the social Buddhism and stream of consciousness Buddhism, or the phenomenology of the mind and understanding the mind. And the monasticism would be silly or just a bunch of rule keeping if we didn't have the Dhamma. But if we didn't have the rules as monastic practitioners, if we didn't have a social structure, the practice of Dhamma would be very difficult because it would be anarchic, it would just be anarchy, it wouldn't work. And the Buddha said you need both. You need good social structures and you need Dhamma. And the development of good social structures for practice is something that the lay people have to kind of figure out. Lay people are always asking monastics, well, how do I do it at home? Beats me. That's how I became a monk. So I wish there was some easy, how do you raise kids? Don't know. I mean, kids. So that's where lay people can often, that's where it's very important to have Kalyanamitta, spiritual friends who, you have other people who have raised kids. How do you do it? How do you do this dharma? How do you use money? I don't know how to use money. How do you cook? I'm just learning how to cook. So there are many issues that actually these two probably know a lot about those things. They have children in the world, so I don't. So there's ethical issues, there's issues about euthanasia and abortion and the ecology and war and peace. There's so much that is discussed in Buddhist circles, but a retreat is really more to learn about meditation. That's how I see it. And then the social issues are discussed in other places. We have a living Dharma study program. If anyone's interested in being on our mailing list, Dina will be available for her email message. Dina is there. And so we're trying to cover social issues there and all of that. But in terms of a retreat, I always think, well, here's a chance to hopefully learn to meditate. And what I really hope for people is, first of all, to kind of clear away some of the backlog, because I do see the environments of lay life are often very, 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 very stressful. They're not really built for Nibbana. And so just my hope is that people would come and just relieve some of that tension, but in a really skillful way, not just in a sort of distracted way. And what I really would like is that the people find the zafu to be a kind of Look, I'm looking at that Zafuna. Like, is that? Do I look at that as the kind of the war field? You know, and I'm gonna, oh gosh, I'm gonna sit on that cushion and fight now. Or do I see it? Oh, great, the cushion. There's my old trusty cushion. Get on that old cushion and just settle the mind down. If you can make that your meditation, where it's, ah, my cushion. But if it's, oh gosh, I've got to meditate, you know, it's that battlefield again. Or, oh, God, still working on that first jhana. Gee, and oh, I've got this anger problem, I've got this knee problem, I've got this fear problem. If that's what meditation is, you won't. Even who wants to do that? It's just this kind of struggle and battle and or my duty. You know, I have to meditate because the Bhante said. You know, and but if it can be a place that you really like to go to, it's a place where you, and what would that require? What would that require? Well, it would require the understanding that but that's probably the best place to liberate some of the tension from the mind. Because I know, like, I was really exhausted before the sitting. And just you know, complain, yeah, complain, yeah, just settle down, it's, oh, so nice to sit. So if you can get to that in your sitting practice, where it is a place that you can come to the sense of relaxation. But if meditation is one where you're always struggling with your meditation object, right, then what do you do with all that stress? You know, you have to kind of get rid of the stress, and now I have to meditate, which is again stress. You sort of double your stress, and then you won't sit. You do it a few times out of sort of, you know, it's your duty to sit after the retreat, and then you just kind of wave to the Buddha on the way to the work. it's not gonna go. So I, you know, what I hope is, what is your attitude that you bring to meditation? And that's what I was reflecting a lot on this retreat, how a teacher must be just a sort of, hopefully a mirror for a cultural perceptions and cultural ways that we operate, and certainly I can sense, I don't find that people are lazy. I rarely find that. And people are so diligent. When you look at this room, even just coming back, so that's that. I never have to say thou shalt sit, you know, or else, and I don't have to kind of go check your room and you know, get on your case, because people are very, very diligent. But where people seem to have a lot of problems, just take it easy. Can you just take it easy on the cushion? So that's why I suppose I'm always reflecting back what I hear through interviews. It's like, be kind, be patient, it's okay, you know where to go. Again, if we're all shooting up heroin, I'd probably have a different take on it. You know, if we're all just kind of running off to the pub, or that doesn't seem to be a problem. So I would... The thing I would ask everyone to reflect on, what is right effort? What does that mean for you? And is there this inner tyrant? Is there this voice that is never, where you're never up to the mark? If there is that voice, then don't believe it. Make it absurd. Chuckle with it. Tell me, get the hell out of here, whatever it takes. But you can't live a life of inner tyranny. It's a pointless way to live one's life. So if you can hear, if that is a voice that comes up, it should be the judgments that what Ajahn Sumedho calls that kind of inner tyranny. Then how can one have humor around that, or how can one come to some sense of self-respect, to the goodness of one's own life? And we find that throughout our culture, don't we? And then I'm sure there are 10-step books about that, that one can hear about. But to listen to that voice and not believe it, to reflect. So like on this retreat, If a retreat is a matter of success and failure, and if there's a sort of inner voice which is very judgmental, then you're probably getting, well, maybe it'll give you a C+ if you're really lucky, right? But if you're not into gradations and judgments and so on, and you look at really what a retreat is about, there's a huge level of renunciation. There's a huge level of being patient with a lot of difficult things. There's this real surrender to something quite difficult. There's the ability to just listen to me so often, going on what I'm saying. There's so much goodness in a retreat, which it's not like experiential. You know, the experience of the retreat is, you know, maybe falling asleep, or you get a lot of emotional material coming up, blah 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 blah. But what are the underlying things one has done are really profoundly good. Just to be patient with a recalcitrant mind for a whole day. You know? Anita can't do it, right? And she, you can see, she really respects that. People really respect that. So can we have that self-respect? I think that's very important. Because otherwise it's hard to do the work. It is hard work. So try to, not in a smarmy way, ain't I wonderful, I did a 10-day retreat. You know, it's not sentimentality. It's wisdom. Otherwise the voices of self-destruction are just go on and on and on. And they begin to haunt the mind, don't they? These kind of haunting things that float around in the mind. So, these interviews, I'm always amazed at what good beings I can talk with. All these kind of different difficult mind states that people go through, and the ability to sit through pain and all that. They're not just kind of sitting here complimenting you so you give me a gold star later. You know, it's not that. It's just this tendency in our culture, I guess, of this endless criticism, this endless sort of voices of judgment, which is different than seeing cause and effect. Because cause and effect is seeing the flow of consciousness and saying, right, that's a place that needs to work. Okay, great. Or when speech is this way, it's destructive. Great, have to work on right speech. Whereas the judgmental voices are part of self-view. It's the, I'm not up to the mark, I'm no good, I should have done it better. And that self-view is delusion. So that's what you have to differentiate between seeing with this as a result. When I do this way, I get a good result. When I do it that way, I get a bad result. I'm going to go for the good results. That's fine. That's judicious. Whereas the self-view, this insidious voice of comparison, judgment, and that's delusion. That's the delusion of self. So in whatever ways it comes up, it's what we call, what's it in the Pali? I-making, my-making, they call it, translation. It's this concoction, this creation of a me and a mind all the time going on in the mind, those kind of voices. And they can be known. They can be known as voices. But they are, the trouble is they're very believable, aren't they? And that's the nature of avijja. Avijja is ignorance, not seen clearly. And vijja is nation, it's like seeing clearly the way things are. That's just a thought. That's a habit pattern. And the more deluding they are, the more difficult it is to see them. So in terms of social dharma that you're developing, there are just the general suggestions of living morally. But a big part of our training as monastics is sense restraint, contentment with little, hanging out with good friends, morality, I don't know how you do it in lay life, but this vehicle that you can surrender to, that's incredibly powerful. When you have a form in your life, relationships and that where you can kind of give up to it and watch yourself, it's not as clear in lay life. It can't be. But that's one of the big freedoms of being a monastic, is like there's no freedom to go anywhere. You do it or you don't, basically. And so it's a kind of paradox. There isn't the freedom to select the decor, as it were. but there's the freedom to watch within the decor. You can't really change the furniture all that much, but you can just be and watch. So in modern consumer life, the mind can be very much distracted all the time by getting it right on the external. So contentment with little, rather than the constant upgrade, you know, that kind of mind which, like our culture is always upgrading things, like contentment with little. Sense restraint is a big part in the samvara. And an interest in the mind, an interest in suffering, that's a weird one, isn't it? To actually be interested in your own suffering, not in a self-obsessive way, and where I'm always just thinking about myself, that's where altruism is very important. But an interest in how does it work and why do I suffer? Rather than, oh, there I go, I'm suffering again, or there I go, I'm angry again. And a lifestyle which is much as possible given on, you know, based on giving and generosity, because that's a huge thing if one can have that. So oftentimes you can't. You just have to make your bread the best way you can. So service, but service not as an end in itself. Because if service is the end in itself, service is endless, it can burn you out. But service as a vehicle for watching one's own mind. So like my time now with my mother, it is a time of service, and it's a wonderful time for me, and it's wondrous for her too, although at 89 is a lot of difficulty. But my primary practice is not my mother, it's my heart. Because if I make my mother primary, and I forget my heart, then if it starts to go wonky, I start to burn out, then I won't be of any use to anyone. If I make my heart primary within the function of serving my mother, then I've got the right priorities. If I make the priority being a teacher before practicing Dhamma, I'm toast. Because, well, so much I don't know. I meet people, I think, I hear their interview, I think, could I do the next retreat with you? Yeah, I have to answer. This person is further than me. What am I going to say now? But why? Why should I know everything? I don't. I just can't say what I say. But if I make my primary thing, I am the teacher, you know, I am the authority, and I have to make sure you know the Dharma, blah, blah, blah. And I don't look at conceit and arrogance and fear and all those things that come up as a teacher. I'm toast. Because I then start to play the role of being the teacher. So the role of being a teacher, the role of being a parent, or the role of being a whatever you do, is simply the vehicle you travel in. And then within that, the most important thing is your heart. And heart and mind, then that's the right priority, getting it right that way. Because then you have to lead with the Dhamma, rather than with social conventions. But without social conventions, it doesn't work either. So then, when in social dharmas we lose the ability to be aware of flow of consciousness, then it really gets wonky. We lose the, if we're not in touch with our inner world, then we start to act, and we don't see our intentions, and we don't see where they lead to, and the whole thing gets very, very messy. So hence back to the cushion. You know, is the for me, sitting meditation is very, very important, not as an end in itself, but as a cleansing, as an assessment of what has happened in the day, where my practice is going. As the place to recollect the beautiful, to gladden the heart, at times to deepen samadhi, and so many other things. And so the cushion is a kind of wonderful place. If one can learn to look at meditation that way, it must be like playing the piano. If you're a good pianist, you go to the piano because you like to play, not because your mother telling you to do the scales, right? Or if you paint or you carve or whatever. So if meditation can be that, a beautiful place to go to rather than just a duty, then you want to do it. It won't be just another thing, another chore that you do. But that depends on attitude, on what kind of attitude you bring to meditation. And if, again, if the attitude is one of criticism and judgment and attainment and becoming and that, you won't want to sit. Who wants to do that? That's torture. No one's going to want to sit like that. So that that attitude is so that's why I keep hammering away at just the lovely things of opening the heart. Again, that's not sentimental. Contemplate, what's the difference between sentimentality, cynicism, and sincerity? There is a difference, right? Our culture tends to be pretty cynical, I suppose, huh? Or it's very intellectual, at least. It's interesting, like among monastics, it's interesting, the cynics don't want to do metta practice. They want to contemplate death and corpses, and things like that. And you say, let's do the chanting on suffusion of divine abiding. You say, yuck. Give me a break, will you? Let's get real. I want to do real Buddhism. But the sentimental ones love to do it. Ah. Let's do love. But when I read that letter about Anne, right, those of you who know Anne, and when you think of her and the predicament she and Andrew are in, and your heart opens, now that's not sentimentality. You can take it to sentimentality, or you can take it where you want, but when the heart is open, that's not a function of thought. It isn't, is it? It's a whole different part of our being. And I think if that can come into our sitting practice, then it's no longer me with my mentality and my willfulness trying to impose some idea of Buddhism onto my mind so that I become a better person. That's a disaster that's a recipe for you're never going to do it that way. So that doesn't work, that imposition of thought onto the heart doesn't work. But sentimentality also doesn't work. If I'm just sort of, just trying to make my being high in some kind of sentimental way, that won't work either. So the reality of the heart is that it can be very open and very responsive to life in a very pragmatic way. It's not just about puppy dogs and so on, it's something much more powerful. And so the opening of the heart does have tremendous vitality, it has presence, it has intuition, and it has power. All that can exist from a different place. And then if we have that, then our mental, our intelligence and our heart are wonderfully in balance, because intelligence is important, the ability to analyze is important, the ability to see cause and effect is important, the ability to plan, like Arslan and Philip, the way they've organized their retreat, magnificent. And you can't do that from some kind of sentimental, we'll just practice, right? It'll be disaster, and we'll just let go. So some kind of kind of 70s thing, you'll pass the joint, but no one ever does the dishes. You ever been in those communities? Yeah? So there is a place for intellect, and there is a place for planning, and so on. And there's a place for the heart. And getting those in balance, then you really have the kind of tools for a good life. For a good life, but also for a good spiritual life. So whatever social dharmas you develop, if you have a chance, visit a monastery. Our franchises are all over the world now. But they're good places to visit and get grounded. That's what they're for. Tomorrow, the end game is quite simple. Usually we have a sitting at 9, We'll be sitting before the breakfast, and then we'll, after breakfast we'll meet at 9, and some closing remarks, 5 precepts, and then we usually like to do a sharing circle to finish off, and we'll finish off at lunch. Okay, I'll leave that for tonight.
Hanmayan varadamagataya sadhu karandadamase sadhu sadhu.